Well, hello everyone, and welcome back. Welcome to session two of A New Republic of the Heart, a guide to being the change for real with Terry Patton. Today, we'll be diving into chapter one and look forward to deepening the dialogue with you. My name is Sherry, and I'm part of the Terry Patton support team. When we move into Q&A later in today's session, we warmly invite you to ask a question or share your thoughts in one of three ways. To interact live on video or audio, please click on the raise hand button in the upper left corner or the bottom of your Zoom window. Please leave your hand raised to stay in the queue. We will then bring you backstage and your Zoom window will look like it's collapsing momentarily and you'll be automatically reconnected. Once we've confirmed that your video is clear, Terry will call on you, we'll open your line, and you'll be visible on screen. Please be sure others who may pass through your environment are aware that you are on video, and as well, please refrain from eating, smoking, walking, or other distracting movements. And please do use headphones or a headset if you have them handy to minimize background noise and to ensure the best quality sound and recording. If you do prefer to submit a written question, please use the Q&A button in the same area of your screen. iPad and mobile app users, tap your screen and you'll see the raise hand and Q&A buttons in the upper right. If you've joined us by telephone and wish to interact live, please join us online now as the telephone option is listen only. And finally, if the session should freeze up on you or if you get disconnected, simply click Leave Meeting that appears in red text in the bottom right corner of your Zoom window. iPad and mobile app users, just tap your screen. Leave Meeting will appear in the upper left. Once you have left the meeting, quit all other programs that may be running, any apps that may be running, and use the same link to reconnect with the session. All right, a warm welcome to all of you again, and a warm welcome to you, Terry. Hi.
Hi. Delighted to be beginning again with all of you. So I want to begin a little differently this time. Certainly I want to welcome you. I'm delighted that we're beginning to gather as a community of people who get it, who get the situation we're in, who get the sense of our own personal responsibility, who are really interested to be in the questions together. There's something really profoundly beautiful and sacred about that. And I want to interact with you. So I sent out in the emails that announced this an invitation to begin with live questions. I think that'll be a wonderful beginning point for our conversation. But even before that, I want to set a tone, a sacred container for the conversation. So I'm going to begin by offering a little bit of a guided meditation and to help us make a transition from profane space and profane time, crowded with all the interruptions in our crazy town public world, into the sacred space and the sacred time that we're invoking here to begin an entirely different kind of conversation and to meet with this level of sincerity, vulnerability, and presence to all that is real and good and true and beautiful. So please find your way into a posture with a straight spine, relax your belly, open your feeling down into your feet and your sits bones and into the contact with gravity and the earth. And please open your feeling being from the heart upward, especially the top of your head, to the qualities of light and freedom above. And take a few deep breaths. And let's together feel our sincere appreciation and gratitude for the miracle of life, the wonder of this moment in this beautiful world, for the fellowship of one another in this brother sisterhood we're experimenting with finding our way into together. And feel with the feeling intelligence that integrates the brain in the head, the brain in the heart, and the brain in the gut. With the whole feeling intelligence of the whole being. And close your eyes. Take a couple of breaths in silence. And I see that people are already maybe beginning. I think I saw somebody raising a hand, although I don't see anybody quite yet ready. Let's feel together into these profound, impossible questions that we all share. And into this disposition that is present to the miracle of life and the inherent joy of being. And therefore present in a way that is truly capable of real happiness, even as we are also feelingly present to this enormous civilizational predicament. So we'll stay in this silent feeling mode until Sherry is able to recognize someone who's raised their hands and promote them to panelists. We can interact live. So please go ahead and raise your hand. We'll wait for this call to enter into its interactive portion. I see that Susan is here with a question. Welcome, Susan. You're unmuted. Hi. Susan, you're unmuted. Maybe you're muted locally on your own device. Please go ahead and ask your question or make a comment. There you are.
Okay. What I wanted to share were three quotes from Buckminster Fuller that I thought may just fit right in. The first is, we are called to be architects of the future, not its victims. The second is, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, that one.
Yeah, and the third is, when I am working on a problem, I never think about beauty. But when I have finished, if the solution is not beautiful, I know it is wrong. Mm. That's it.
Those are each really beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, this second one is one I've thought about especially long and hard. And I think that this course, this convening of this set of conversations in a way is an attempt to do exactly what he's talking about, which is to begin to build a different frequency of connection and friendship and community among us that has the potential to make the non-intimate modes of being that are so prevalent and even often dominant in our world obsolete. And that's such a grand ambition, and what we're able to realize at first can seem so small and so just beginning, you know, so nascent, so preliminary, that we very often have a hard time treating it as being as serious, as substantial, as potentially consequential as it ultimately could become. It can become hard for us to invest as much belief and energy and commitment and inspiration as the project by its very nature requires. And so there's a continual process that is part of my practice, and I think, you know, appropriately part of all of our practice, that has to do with sort of suspending that disbelief, suspending our own skepticism, opting in and saying, well, something healthy, different, truly better has to begin now with me in some way. And sometimes all we're able to do is something we see lots of well-intended people doing in this world. And it isn't really such a radically new or different pattern. But if we keep opting into our experiment with one another as if there's no reason it couldn't break new ground, with the sense of possibility, with a willingness for a different paradigm, one that is generous in a different way, one that is that is not weighted down by the conventions of skepticism that ordinarily would prevent us from believing in what we're intending to do. That is how we begin to create this new republic of the heart, this new possibility that, you know, our current way of being a human civilization is going to become obsolete of its own accord. We don't have the weight of trying to make it obsolete, but what we do have the weight on us is to create something that is actually healthy, that expresses wholeness in a more radical way, and that therefore would be able to make it obsolete. Oh, good, we get to see you. Hi, Grant.
Hey, Terry, how are you?
Welcome.
Good morning. I mean, there's many questions I'd like to get into, but one element that you brought up in your book was around this issue of of the need for constant growth in the economy, and the fact that it's really based on a fundamental that I think we're going to have to wrestle with if we're ever going to find a solution. And that's the fact that every dollar that is printed is actually loaned into existence. And that whole trying to keep up with the interest on a go-forward basis is what is kind of underpins this hyper fascination with growth. And your book cautions that it becomes problematic on a planet with finite resources. How could that possibly be? How could infinite growth continue? And I get that. And I imagine some part of the solution may be around a move from a material-based society to growth being indexed by, say, the amount of purpose or the amount of the quality of our connections with others. Coming into community like this, we could amplify this infinitely, and it wouldn't be a draw on resources, say. I imagine it would be moving into the non-material realm, but yet, as we all live in under a dollar system or whatever currency, you know, whatever country we're in, that this whole notion of interest tethered to every dollar brought into the system seems to be at the core of our problem. And I'm just curious about what's the alternative, and if we were to make a change in this arena, are we just essentially canceling all of our debts and starting all over? It's a big problem, and I just I appreciate the fact that you brought it up so early in your book, and I think it's at the fundamental root of any of our efforts to make changes. So I was hoping we could maybe go into that a little bit.
Yeah, I'll be happy to comment on it. I don't think that this is a problem that has a single discrete solution, and that my answer will be an exploration of a deepening of this question rather than a full answering of it. There are many ways this could possibly change. One thing is that there is a very real and widespread movement to create alternative currencies, particularly local currencies or currencies that exist only in a certain ecosystem. And I think that's really healthy and valuable. I do think it's small and kind of at the edges of things. It's not going to change the force of the global economy at first. But those experiments are just like our experiment in community. They're an attempt to make another paradigm work and become healthier. And there are some really vital experiments of that kind. Obviously, the cryptocurrency, particularly Bitcoin, that world is particularly significant in terms of the size of that economy. And it's true that cryptocurrencies are not by their very nature inflationary. They don't bear interest by their structural nature. But they do depend upon Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency mining, which it uses a lot of power, actually. It's much more costly than people realize. And so in a sense, for no obvious, productive, tangible benefit to human lives, we're even more rapidly speeding up our burning of fossil fuels and the whole climate predicament simply through them. So they're not a fully sustainable alternative either. There's also, and much more fundamentally, and this is maybe more at the heart of my answer, there's this whole idea of beginning to participate in a gift economy. That is, recognizing each other as brothers and sisters in a different and more fundamental sense, and beginning to relate to one another with a fundamental attitude of generosity, and recognizing that our generosity and the friendliness with which we extend to one another is generative in profound ways. The basic idea of a gift economy is when I give to you out of the generosity of my heart without necessarily expecting anything in return, it evokes in you a response of gratitude and an impulse to reciprocal generosity, or even to paying it forward to others. And that's the virtuous circle we want to be giving emphasis to. Now, I think that we also have to face the fact that none of these things by themselves are going to convert the momentum of the global economy. They are potentially healthier models in their practices that uplift us, but they don't necessarily create a different pattern altogether. The weight and momentum of economic activity, every one of us has to pay for housing and food and clothing and transportation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, mostly in terms of the coin of the realm, which is dollars or euros or whatever, wherever we live, pesos. And we're all, in that sense, kind of enslaved to that system. And how will that system ever change? Well, unfortunately, that system probably will have additional crises. We had this liquidity crisis in late 2008 that would have made solutions that hitherto had been completely unthinkable politically, completely thinkable. It's like as soon as you have a real financial crash, you can think outside the box. And I think that unfortunately we're going to have such crises, and there will be moments in which policymakers would have an opportunity to do a more fundamental redesign of our currency. And I think that's one of the healthiest places that we could go. It's still going to be difficult. Like, we wouldn't have to cancel out debts to transition from or securities or anything. We could just redefine what a dollar represents, and that dollar would be able to not be inherently interest bearing. But there's still going to be a lot of disruption because lots of people will have retired and be dependent upon the earnings of their savings or investments. And any change at that point, no matter how well you create special programs or allowances as a governmental policymaker to account for the largest numbers of people who would be negatively impacted by any redefinition of the value of the primary currency, there are going to be winners and losers in any redefinition, and it's going to be profoundly disruptive. And it's going to have to be interactive with, see, a financial crash is the thing coupled with loss of faith in government that can create social upheaval and breakdown of civil order. And the breakdown of civil order, particularly in the United States with all the guns that are circulating, is a ugly thing to contemplate. It essentially means at least a temporary dystopian, you know, there's some measure of dystopian things going on, and probably the instantiation of a police state under those circumstances. So our greatest hope is that we have a more enlightened rather than a less enlightened form, you know, people. We have a government and decision maker, collective decision making at the point of any such financial crash or breakdown of civil order that will be doing its best to restore wholeness and order and harmony and some measure of fairness and compassion to a new regime. And at the end of the book, I talk at some length about what I call the ancient strategy. Earlier in a blog post, I called it the Bodhidharma strategy. I think you might remember it. And that idea essentially is that in the anticipation of disruptive events, people who are really serious policy wonks can, over time, build access to key decision makers and well thought out policy proposals such that under the circumstances of one of these disruptive moments, it might be possible to furnish the white papers and the policy proposals that we think are wisest and most benign and most likely to lead toward authentic sustainability. I think that's enough on that topic for now, but I hope that that's helpful.
Yeah, thank you, Terry. And I think given the fact that all oil is still sold in dollars around the world, the petrodollar, I think this move to sustainable energy sources and a move away from a dollar-denominated global system, handcuffed as it is to the trade in oil, is going to be a big part of this. And in fact, I don't think we will get free of one without getting free of the other. Some of my more conspiratorial friends would suggest that if we look around the world at some of the people who've tried to sell oil without outside of the dollar system, whether it's Hugo Chavez or who's the other guy?
Iran was doing it for a while.
Yeah, Iran and Libya, the guy in Libya, Gaddafi. These people that kind of mysteriously find themselves no longer among the living when they try to move around the dollar system. It may be warning for us, as revolutionaries and evolutionaries, as we begin to try to push against the system, that we may find resistance among those who have vested interests in the current system of oil and dollars and the petrodollar and how they're tied together in a kind of incestuous way. So hopefully our move to sustainable energy might be a time for us to find our way to a currency that's not predicated on printing dollars out of thin air that have interest accrued to them immediately and forcing us into debt slavery for forever. But it's a complicated issue, but hopefully it's all part of a sustainable future.
The potential, one of my ideas, one of the fundamentals of what I hope to be founding. I haven't talked about this so much to this group of folks in this gathering, but I'm launching a nonprofit that can be a vehicle for the educational and community building dimensions of this new Republic of the Heart coming into being. But I don't think that this nonprofit can be a vehicle for all the integral revolutionary activities that I think are important. I don't think we can quite get our act together in time to be a force during the midterms this year, but I think that another way of engaging is political. In some countries, that coincides with the founding of a political party, and there's a pretty enlightened political party already represented in the Danish parliament. There was an integral political party founded in Switzerland even longer ago. There's a new party in Sweden too. There's a book, a theoretical book of a kind of integral politics called Metamodern Politics that's having some influence in Europe. And I think along the same lines in the United States, because we have a two-party monopoly, a third party isn't, unfortunately, yet a viable focus for our engagement. But it can be that you can pool a lot of political donations and allocate them to key congressional candidacies, would be the focus probably during this, or Senate candidacies during this upcoming midterm in the United States. And then along the lines of what I did with my Integral Obama initiative in 2012, we can identify some key enlightened policy ideas that we want those who benefited from our donations to seriously consider bringing forward in some way. We'd have to think very clearly about what is, what's the highest level, what are the going to be the highest leverage policy proposals that we would want the beneficiaries of our donations to seriously carry forward in wherever they're represented. But I think that that's a very important piece of it. But then I think there's another completely different organization that is not political, but is really all about technological innovation. And I've put some serious time and care and even some money into an initiative around another whole approach, which kind of has to do with wise stewardship of transformational technology. And the basic concept of that is that it is extremely probable that there will be disruptive technologies, some of which will be black swans, some of which, you know, there are all the hip tech people are talking already about biotech and robotics and nanotech and informational technology and superintelligence and how these are going to revolutionize our world. But I think there are also going to be some surprises, some so-called black swan events. And some of the people who are bringing those forward are going to care that their technology is stewarded in a way that's pro-social, pro-future. And I think that there are going to be some pretty substantial investors who are going to want to see the world changed with world-changing investments. So I think there's room for another for-profit entity that would, you might think of it as a venture fund, but it isn't really money looking for winning investments. It's more like stewardship as the key ingredient. So it's a wisdom circle that would attract both the technologies and the money. And that has to interact with this issue of currency. If it in fact included a technology that would disrupt the fossil fuel foundations of our current economy, it would have to interact in just the ways you're describing with the currency issues. So, I mean, that's kind of an intellectual abstract thing, but it's part of my strategic thinking, and it does address what you're observing. So thank you very much for bringing that forward.
Yeah. Thanks, Terry.
Great. Well, I see we have a couple of other people who've come forward. Christina. Hi. Welcome.
Oh, great. Thank you very much, Terry and all. My name is Christina. I'm calling from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And I've got actually a basic question in terms of to ask your help to clarify a little bit more in terms of the type of conversation that you talk in the book, because something that is a little bit confusing for me is because we currently live in this kind of cultural clash, cultural war, where especially here, particularly in Brazil, but in many countries where we have multiple stages of development online at this moment, like using the color like red, amber, yellow, green, and everybody speaking different things and people hearing different things. So when you talk about having profound conversations and subculture conversations, do you mean uniting those different people from different stages of development so we are able to have conversations with all of them? Or do you mean selecting individuals who are already at a later stage and who can more easily advance to another stage of development, because we cannot force some values on someone who are not ready for that? So that is a basic question that I would love you to clarify, please. And also on top of this, you were talking about the gift economy and about the feelings that can generate upon our behavior on our offer. And my question is, do you think that we have a universal values that are common along those different structures of development? That is another question that I have. Thank you so much.
Yeah, those are, again, the really good questions are questions that we are going to deepen in our relationship to, not simply answer and do away with. So I don't think the the things you're caring about when you bring forward this question remain as deep questions that we have to stay in an inquiry in relationship to. So we don't dispatch them. I think that we'll get into this in a lot more depth in the later sessions of this course. In a way, the question you're asking right now isn't so much about what's in chapter one as it is about what's in chapters 10 and 11, or 9, 10, and 11, actually. But I think that we have to have a whole bunch of different kinds of conversations, and that all of them perform critical functions in terms of the evolution of consciousness and culture and the reknitting of the social fabric and reestablishing wholeness in a whole variety of ways. But there's an awful lot of conversation going on right now in the United States, and perhaps this is also true in Brazil, about reknitting the social contract across the liberal, conservative, left-right divide. And that's what everything is focused on. And often it's the populists of the left or the right who are creating a kind of threat of violence in the system that makes everybody afraid of what that could bring. And then, oh, well, we really have to learn to talk because we don't want to degenerate into a breakdown of our civic discourse and our ability to make wise decisions together. However, I think right now our opportunity is really to talk with people in the later stages of development who have access to higher states of consciousness as well as higher structures and stages of consciousness, and for us to begin to pilot a whole different level of brother sisterhood and communion. In evolutionary theory, the next stage of development that might be possible beyond what we see today would be a human superorganism, a social holon that would be so efficient that it would function at a whole new level. That would be a sangha, and an idea that I speak about often in the book, which we'll get into again and again across these weeks, the idea that the next Buddha may very well be a sangha, and that our work might be in our own practice to become more and more capable of the intelligence and self-discipline and clarity and awakening and love that are required for us to participate as a real citizen of such a sangha or new republic of the heart. So I think we can practice our ways of being with one another right here, even in our book study groups, even in our time with one another on our calls like now. And therefore, that's what I will be focusing on with all of you. It's also, it isn't as though I don't, however, mean to say that we have to accomplish all of that before we even begin to bridge these other social divides and have conversations between different worldviews. Our different worldviews do have to come into deeper conversation. One of the initiatives that I'm very inspired about, Living Room Conversations, that Joan Blades, who's of the left, she had founded MoveOn.org, and John Gable, who's of the right, have brought together as conversations that do bridge that cultural divide. And it's something I think is a huge priority for us. I also think that there are some particular conversations, and in the chapter 10, I talk about three groups, and we'll get into that, the innovators, the ecologists, and the evolutionaries, and we'll talk about that. So I think there's a whole host of conversations that are super important, and one of the first, not the very first, but one of the very early projects of the nonprofit will be, I'd like to launch a podcast. I used to conduct public conversations through the Beyond Awakening teleseminar series, and I want to start a podcast where I'll try to model different ways of talking, not all of which will be about this higher we space, this deeper, higher level kind of interaction. So it's a both and answer. We really need all of it. I think that you and I probably have, you know, some of us may have real expertise and real opportunities to bridge social divides in our communities and in our nations. And I think that work is super important, and I don't want anybody to feel undermined. But I think that for most of us, the place where we can make the biggest contribution is at the level of this higher integral evolutionary we space. And that's what we will be able to do a little bit of even here in this course. So that is what I'm focusing on, but not to the exclusion of the others. And did I answer all your questions, or was there something left?
Thank you so much, Terry. The other question that I asked was regarding the feelings of gratitude, generosity, and how does this resonate with different worldviews? How do you think they express? So do you think that there are
I think to some degree it's a universal solvent. Kindness, mm-hmm. love is a universal solvent. It does wash through different worldviews. And everybody has access to some measure of it. One of the things that Charles Eisenstein points out in his book, Sacred Economics, is that the use of currency to create a fairness in the value exchange that of every value exchange breaks down something very human. Like if I babysit for you because I want you to be able to be free to go out and I like your kids, the bond between us is very rich. And then if you then want to give me stuff from your garden because you just feel how much I've extended to you, our bond is very rich. But if I pay you, you know, if you pay me $30 for the babysitting and I pay you $30 for the produce, it deadens the humanity of the exchange. And this commodification of exchange is something we're all suffering. So the restoration, the simple acts of kindness and generosity are very much, I mean, I think it's a political act to just discover a way to make empathetic, compassionate eye contact with a stranger in public. You know, not weirdly, intensely looking at somebody and creeping them out, but just breaking through the and anonymity is worthwhile. Little acts of kindness, letting somebody go through the door first, or lifting something for someone, or opening a door, or whatever. All these little acts of kindness are what leaven our world. And so those are important. They're part of what I call the social mycelium in the book. But they are not sufficient as a social change strategy. I do think that this principle and spirit of a gift economy is important in that it pervades everything. Yeah. So I hope that's helpful. Thank you so much, Christina. And it's great to hear from you in Rio. My heart goes out to every Brazilian over the loss of your beautiful museum. I'm sure that everyone's heart is broken over the loss of so much there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Take care. Marjorie, hi. You're unmuted, or you will be in a second.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Wow, I had asked a question last week that you had said you might want to address this week, but I also have another question now that I've finished reading chapter one, and I mean, I've read the whole book, but I'm going back and rereading it. And at the end of chapter one, you say something like, this new republic of the heart can go forward. And then the last sentence, if that is, we grow up and show up at our very best. And it seems to me that obviously right now, as a collective, we are not functioning at our best. We're barely functioning, I mean, you know. And I sort of feel like those of Trump and his followers are representing the belly side, the underside of the collective, and that perhaps they are actually the scapegoat for the rest of us. And so I'm just wondering, as we go forward to this new Republic of the Heart, for each of us individually, we hope that we're functioning at our best and that we strive for that. But there's going to be a part of us that is not functioning at our best, or that is the shadow side of ourselves. And I'm just, you know, thinking that we're going to have to go forward anyway. We're going to have to move forward even when we're not functioning at our best, or even if somehow, I mean, I'm trying to figure this all out and trying to piece this together for myself. And I'm just wondering if you can shed some light on that.
Yeah, I can. Well, first of all, the whole principle of how to deal with with political irresponsibility, which is what we have. You might say pathology or psychopathology, sociopathology expressing itself in socio-political terms. We clearly see that there's something really sick about this, that it needs to not carry the day. But that doesn't necessarily mean that our only move is to simply oppose it. However, one of our moves is to oppose it. One of the ways of understanding what's going on in the United States with Trump is to analyze it in terms of the colors, the spiral dynamics or Wilberian color scheme, in which we would say that the Republican Party was amber or blue, that there was a modernist center of gravity in American politics that was either sympathetic to traditional values, amber or blue on the Republican side, or postmodern values, green on the Democratic side. The Democratic side is modernist and postmodernist, the Republican modernist and traditional. And that there's been this populist upwelling that's essentially red that has taken over the Republican Party. And so what we're dealing with is opportunism, selfishness. And the thing about red is at the level of the kind of society we have right now, it's a pathology. It's a cultural regression. And it's essentially negative. And the only thing that red understands, according to that system, is power. It needs essentially to be overpowered. That trying to be more understanding, trying to be more sympathetic, trying to get their point of view, futile. You're going to simply have to overpower them. You're going to have to, the only way you're going to be effective with that kind of action logic, the logic of the action of people who are thinking like that, is such that they simply have to lose. They have, you know, we all win some and lose some. They have to lose some at this point in time. That's the best understanding. And there's a lot of truth in that. But as an individual, we're always faced with individuals in our lives. And there are Trump supporters who are, well, there are some Trump supporters. I think Trump managed to get 100% of the psychopath vote, the racist vote, the psychopath vote, the ethnocentrically violent, you know, Nazi vote. He got all the Nazis vote for him. So there is a faction within the Trump supporting world that is functionally as if evil. We can't really reason with it. But most of the Trump-supporting world is much, much better than that, much healthier than that, much more capable of wholeness. And in that regard, I think the most effective thing we can do in our conversations with Trump supporters very often is to find places where we resonate. Often the deepest place we can resonate is over common shared values, but often the first thing you have to resonate over is maybe, I don't know, cooking or cars or, you know, something you're both interested in that you genuinely enjoy. It gives you a chance to remind yourselves of your human connections. When there's a family connection, when there's genuinely some, you know, we both love grandma, you know, whatever it is, there's an opportunity to resonate. And sometimes the most creative things that we can do in these difficult conversations is to just restore social bonds. So that's often the skillful move that's available to us. As far as understanding the, you know, the best, our showing up at our best, showing up at our worst, how are we at our worst now? How are we at our best? What can we do to restore our best? The most important thing that you can do is to be a practitioner, which means that you have to be both yin and yang. That is, you have to be questioning yourself, opening yourself up to new possibilities, willing to learn in beginner's mind, holding these big questions. Those are yin moves, and they tend to be the rare moves. I emphasize them a lot in my book because, you know, in that yin-yang symbol, there's a little dot of white in the black side and a little dot of white in the... That means that the source of the power of the yang is yin. If we really want to kick ass, we've got to yawn open into a kind of profound receptivity and surrender from which comes a kind of truth, a kind of inherent authority out of which we're more powerful. And that's super important. So there is that. But equally, we have to be yang, and that yangness on the superficial level means that our practice has to involve us striving for excellence, not just reformatting the hard drive, not just popping over to a new paradigm, but being as healthy and as productive and as willing to endure the discomfort that is a part of self-transcending practice for everyone at every time. And therefore, the more that you are alive in a process, a self-transforming process that is getting you outside your comfort zone, that you're waking up, you really are getting past it, you're getting over yourself, you're not just sleepwalking in the same old, but you're actually breaking new ground. That is what is going to give your conversations with other people a possibility, a liveliness, a potential for creativity, even a humor and a playfulness and a capacity for affection, a little, you know, sexiness, you know, like all the pizzazz that makes things really flow comes from you really being alive, really showing up for the next new moment with that kind of openness and that kind of curiosity and that committed energy that has you bright, that has you alive, that has you showing up for this event of life. And that's showing up at our very best. And so finding ways for us to be doing that and talking about it, doing it in a self-aware, self-perpetuating way, that's the key. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah. Can I ask another question?
Okay.
Because
I don't see anybody. By the way, go ahead and raise your hands. I don't think I see anybody else queued up behind Marjorie, so questions are appreciated. Go ahead, Marjorie.
Yeah, I think what I'm tapping into is that when we are striving to be our best, there is the shadow side of that. And I think, unless I've got it wrong, which is certainly possible, even at the higher levels of development, there's still shadow, or there's still the parts of us that we do not want to acknowledge. And so even when we're striving to function at our best, the aspects of us that do not function at our best, or that are negative, or that are weak,
right,
or asleep,
right, you
know, I think that's where, and I know it's the whole paradox is what we're actually tapping into here, but to be able to hold space for all of it, to be whole, would allow space for the aspects of ourselves that are not strong, that are weak, or that, you know, I mean, we're humans.
Well, the way that, you know, the shadow is not, that's such a deep topic, and it can be explored, you know, very, very deeply for a very long period of time. I want to offer a rather brief answer at the moment. Mm-hmm. If we're self-skeptical, if we get that shadow operates in every psyche, and we are to some degree self-skeptical, and we really practice beyond the negativity of our being, such that we're finding our way to a positive, you know, proactive, engage. Like when you're practicing, you're not enacting a dejected, depressed, you're in a somewhat can-do mode. You're finding your way past things. So shadow, the fact that shadow will tend to operate needs some measure of attention, but the fact that that shadow, that you're opting to really bring in the light is where you're standing. And so that continued bringing forth of what's best in yourself to some degree accounts for it. Yes, the shadow will creep in, and you need to continue to be humble enough and self-skeptical enough that you keep growing, but don't let that become your excuse for losing that fundamentally can-do, positive, proactive orientation that really is the soul of practice. So I just put that forward for now, and this is a topic we can go into more. There'll be quite a few opportunities to explore the shadow in the weeks ahead.
One of the supplemental readings you suggested was What Lies Beneath, the understatement of essential climate risk. And I read that and was really not surprised, but, you know, goes into tipping points, carbon budgets, Arctic sea ice, polar ice mass, sea level rise, that kind of thing. It is kind of in the context of the United Nations climate report, with statements from scientists, and the net of it is that the report obviously underestimated the risk and the reality speed of the situation.
And the speed with which it's moving, yeah.
Right, so I want to understand what the integral analysis of that kind of problem is. In other words, how could it, you know, if I as a person go to a doctor and I get tested and the doctor says, you got to do this, I'm going to do it. But essentially, that's at a global level. We have the evidence, you know, the tests, and yet there's a lack of a response and a lack of will and underestimation. So what's the integral view of the source of this problem?
Well, I don't think there's one single integral view. There are integral years ago, Ken Wilber interviewed Michael Crichton on Integral Naked, and Michael Crichton was expressing some skepticism about the climate science. Michael Zimmerman, the co-author of Integral Ecology, is also, he's a lifelong environmentalist and a friend who I really respect, but he also detected various kinds of groupthink among climate scientists and had room in his mind for some measure of skepticism. One of the ideas I put forward in chapter 6 of the book, which we'll get to in a few weeks, is the idea that there is no one integral view that can bring together all the perspectives that are necessary, but that the integral practice is to, and I use, I put quotes around the phrase, to be in conversation with, that we can be in conversation with a variety of perspectives that have relevance and that need to be taken into account. And so I am in conversation with a whole variety of perspectives. I think that the particular perspective embodied in that report, the What Lies Beneath report, is particularly important because it's a scientifically based empirical attempt to, you know, that it's a modernist document, that is a rational document that imagines that there's such a thing as an objective truth and that tries to get at it and that drives at what has tended to be missing from the global conversation about climate change, the IPCC report. And what it says is there's a systematic bias against appearing alarmist because there are so many attacks from vested interests. In the United States, we would say they're on the right. And that therefore, because of this potential vulnerability to attack, the climate sciences scientists have consistently equivocated in ways that have understated the urgency and the speed with which this disruption can take place. And I want to be in conversation with that point of view. And I think that it has a lot more substance than men, you know, everybody's got an opinion, but there's a lot of science behind that argument. I don't think that it's necessarily the final word, however. I think that I need to be in conversation with it and I take it very seriously. And I think that there are the potential for positive black swan events that create a future very different from what it seems to imagine is likely. Now, an integral relationship to all this, in my view, right now needs to bias toward the position that has been called alarmist, but it needs to bias toward taking radically seriously an urgent civilizational dilemma and having real conversation about it in a way that we tend not to do, but not in the mode of anxiety and alarm. Usually recognizing urgency, we tighten up and we think, I've got to do something now, and we narrow down our attention to a more narrow focus. And that way of responding to this is not going to bring out our best or produce what we need. So it's a little bit paradoxical because a lot of what we have to take seriously tends to draw us toward a way of being that isn't really optimally, that isn't optimal. That there's a, I keep talking about passing through the darkness to a different kind of positivity on the other side. And so that has to be emphasized because a cool, objective discussion of the facts is, you know, the postmodernists are right that is impossible. That our emotions, our responses, everything we care about being threatened, that comes into play and that affects things. Right. So I suggested some caution when I recommended that reading. I said, it's more challenging, it's not for the faint of heart. And I think that there is something to practice with. I think that is, I imagine you're asking the question because you found it really disturbing. And sure. And the way that you're disturbed by it, I think of as being really valuable grist for the mill of your own maturation and growth and development. And so I'm wanting to acknowledge that that's also a part of what we're dealing with when we talk about this.
It does seem to be the nature of politics and human consciousness that the right, sort of the corporate mentality has, they're sort of defending the turf. In effect, they have an easier position or a more popular position than the other side, don't you think? I mean, because the other side requires people to make sacrifices and to be challenged, as opposed to going along with business as usual.
Well, that's right, except they fare better until you have Hurricane Harvey. They fare better until you have the wildfires wiping out 5,000 homes in Sonoma County and Napa. They fare better until the actual objective consequences of climate change being more rapid and sudden and profoundly disruptive than they have accounted for are breaking through that denial barrier. So, alas, in ways we wish were not the case, time is on our side in terms of the argument itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the part of what we're dealing with is being here with each other in the midst of a very, I think you're going through a stark confrontation with a shocking reality that you're absorbing more fully as you face the information in that particular report. And I honor that, and I want to be your friend in it. And I think something is really good for us on the other side of it. And in a way, I need to allow you to have your own passage through that lonesome valley, because that's what's stealing your spine and tempering your soul and deepening you to be a full participant in another possibility. And the courage and intellectual and moral integrity that causes you to take it seriously, I want to honor, respect, appreciate, you know, express fellowship with, but to some degree, to trust your process and let you, you know, in some sense, it's like I'll meet you on the other side, you know, like the deepest work is on the other side of some reckoning that we're all going through.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Carrie, I want to take your question soon, but there's something important that I want to make sure we're able to do. I hope many of you will be able to stay a little later than the 1:15. It's only in 7 minutes. And I want to ask Sherry to help us do a poll, because we might want to change something about the way we set up these calls. And I want to hear from everyone who's on the call right now how you feel about this possible change, which Sherry can explain. And then after Sherry's done, I'll come back and call on you, Carrie, and we can continue.
Okay, great. Thanks, Terry. So many of you have written in and requested a little bit more of a community feel. So we would love to create that with you. And there are a couple of differences. I'm just going to go over some pros and cons of Zoom webinar versus Zoom meeting. So those will be our two choices that will appear on a poll on your screen in just a moment, but let me just give you a little bit of background. So with webinar, which is the platform we're using currently, we used last week and this week, it's a very simple, straightforward platform. Anyone asking a question, as you've seen today, can appear on video, and there's minimal visual distraction and possibly less of a community feel. We opted to go with webinar originally because of in an attempt to reduce the visual distractions. So the second option is Zoom meeting. And in Zoom meeting, we can see each other. You'll be able to see everyone in the call if you wish to turn on your video. There's a stronger sense of community that comes with that. There's more opportunity for conversation with the option to move into smaller discussion groups. The meeting option can come with a little bit of distraction just because we do see everyone on video. Now we can and will invite you to keep your video turned off during certain portions of the call. And the only other drawback of meeting, which is fairly simple, it would just mean a little more, a bit of a change in the meeting number and link. So we would communicate that to you by email, but that's the only other little glitch. So given that information and other information that you may have in other experiences, I'll send out the poll now. And if you could
just respond by checking either Zoom webinar or Zoom meeting, and then please remember to click the submit button. You should be seeing that on your screen now. We'll take about 20 to 30 seconds. The votes are coming in quickly. Thank you so much for participating. We'll just wait a few more seconds. Things are slowing down a little.
Yeah, everybody, we appreciate it if you can all vote. That's helpful to us. Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to call on Carrie now. We'll take that into account. We may make a change. We think there are pluses and minuses to all of this. So, Carrie, welcome. We can't seem to hear you.
No, I'm sorry, Carrie. We'll have to...
Is there any, can you unplug and just talk through your computer speaker? Try that. Huh. You must be your system's preferences. If you've got a Mac, we may not be able to get your question. Well, next time. Well, folks, maybe we will be able to end closer to on time. I'd like to take a moment. This particular session, by its very nature, was a little bit more conceptual and a little bit more, less transformational, I would say, more a matter of understanding our situation. And I did a little, I'd say my answers to the questions were, well, there are other ways of interacting that are possible that I hope will begin to come into our future meetings more richly. However, everything we talked about in terms of understanding it more clearly, and in a way, this was a, I'd say didactic, more academic exploration of the ideas here. And there's something about that, what I was addressing is that's juicy to our understanding, but it's not as juicy to our feeling. And it's important to me that our gatherings also be juicy to our feeling being. So I want to take a moment to go into one of the things I do that's probably among the juiciest, which is prayer. So, I don't pray to some imagined mythic God. I pray to the unimaginable source of all things, the one who causes me to meet the people that come into my life that are wonderful and that create more learning and love and community, the invisible source of inspiration and understanding, the invisible source of all good things in life, upon which I realize I am completely dependent. And I want to take a moment to turn to that source. You are, in some sense, my deepest relation. You who are beating my heart. I do not know who you are or where you are, and yet I'm so grateful. I am, in fact, to turn to you seems almost impossible because you're not separate from me. And yet you are grace itself. You are everything that I love. You are that. You are the one to whom all gratitude ultimately goes. You are the divine. You are the mystery itself. You are isness itself. Thank you so much. Thank you for giving us the courage, the intellectual honesty, the seriousness, and the sense of humor that make it possible for us to stick our heads up above the consensus trance of denial and face what's hardest to face and somehow have what's best in our hearts and spirits survive that, such that we can have a deeper, more profound, more authentic meeting with ourselves and with reality and with each other. Please help us to stay in this process, to keep learning, to keep exploring, to keep deepening, and to make the best use possible of our opportunities together as we explore all this. Thank you so much. Please grace us, grace everyone with new strength, new willingness, new humility, new courage, new commitment, such that what we do here together finds new traction and new depth and new expression in the time ahead. Thank you so much. Okay. Well, we will be finishing up here in a minute. I will send you some deepening questions and reflection questions for chapter two. It'll be posted on our course homepage probably any minute. You'll also find the MP3 and PDF of chapter two. And we'll gather again next week at this time to have another exploratory session. And we'll let you know in the meantime about any changes. Also tomorrow, oh, this is very important. I hope you have, not too many people have left. Your last opportunity to ask to be put into a group where we will, you'll be able to meet and discuss these points is today. So we need to get those from you. And we'll take what we get, and tomorrow we'll create the groups and we'll put you in touch with people who might be able to meet with you. So we hope that aspect of the course will begin very soon. Thanks so much. Take care.